We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Some 23,000 members of the California Nurses Association plan to picket more than 30 Kaiser and Sutter health facilities in Northern and Central California. For NPR News, I'm Shirley Jihad in Los Angeles.
A new tropical storm is turning in the Pacific south of Mexico. Hillary has top sustained winds near 40 miles per hour, and it's expected to grow into a hurricane within days. In that time, another tropical storm out in the Atlantic, Ophelia, is expected to weaken. Here's the latest from Wall Street. The Dow is down nearly 40 points at 11,371. NASDAQ gaining, though, 14 points at 2,604. S&P 500 down slightly at 1,198. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sit for Less, selling all colors of the Herman Miller Aeron chair online, including Sit for Less True Black, online at sitforless.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
On the next Fresh Air, some advice on how to figure out what medical option is best for you when faced with difficult decisions about medications and interventions. We talk with doctors Jerome Groopman and Pamela Hartsband about their new book, Your Medical Mind. Also, former Jeopardy champ Ken Jennings. His new book, Maphead, is about the world of map nerds. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour 2 of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls.
I'm Stephen Lyons, today's host of Focus. Today I have the great pleasure of having a conversation with Eric Greitens, the author of The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. Eric is also the author and photographer of the 2008 book, Strength and Compassion. In addition to being an author, a Rhodes Scholar, a former Navy SEAL, and an active member of the Reserves, Eric is the CEO and founder of the St. Louis-based organization, The Mission Continues. The Mission Continues helps wounded and disabled veterans throughout the United States by awarding them fellowships and helping them continue their service with nonprofit agencies. More about that in a minute. Writing about Eric in The Heart and the Fist, Tom Brokaw says, "His life and this book remind us that America remains the land of the brave and generous. The Heart and the Fist are just the combination we need." Robert Kaplan, senior fellow at the Center for the New American Security, writes, "If the United States is going to continue to be the indispensable nation in the 21st century, it is going to require an elite core of both warriors and humanitarians that combine hard and soft power. Eric Greitens, both in his personal example and in his book, points the way forward." This is my second conversation with Eric. When I was on a magazine assignment in February, I sat down with Eric in St. Louis. As a way of introducing Eric, I'd like to read a few notes from that conversation. Before he was even out of college, Eric Greitens had volunteered in India, Bolivia, China, Rwanda, and Bosnia. He helped people who were suffering, victims of abuse, genocide, and war. He thought he was doing all he could until a woman confronted him on a train to Croatia. She said, "Why isn't America doing anything to stop the ethnic cleansing, to stop the rapes, to stop the murders?" Out of this experience came a philosophy of life that is the heart of Eric's new book, A Combination of the Heart and the Fist. At its core, it's a book about what it takes to live well, a philosophy of life. Eric told me, "Think of it as compassion that's necessary to be loving and to be receptive to people who are hurting, and the courage that it takes to genuinely care for somebody else." It's this philosophy that led Eric to the SEALs. He just graduated from Oxford, and a world of privilege beckoned. Instead, he remembered the angry woman on the train to Croatia. He listened to his heart. He wanted to serve America, and he signed on for Navy SEAL training at the age of 26. Eric was among the 21 out of the original 220 trainees to graduate. Eventually, he would be wounded in Iraq by a suicide truck bomb filled with chlorine gas. Luck was on his side that day. Despite some burns and a scalp full of concrete fragments, Eric returned to active duty in 72 hours. After his tour of duty ended, he went to Bethesda Naval Hospital to visit wounded veterans. To a soldier, each man and woman wanted to return to his or her unit. For most, that simply wasn't an option. Eric said he wanted to do something for these veterans. Eric told me, "One of the great principles of military leadership is that you take care of your guys. For me, that doesn't end when you step off the battlefield. If I wasn't going to do this for them, who would?" He knew there'd be parades for these wounded warriors when they returned to their hometowns. They'd get free gift baskets, cell phones, movie tickets, and other material gifts. But then what? Eric said, "The most important thing for everyone to understand about returning veterans is that they are an asset to the country, and that because of their military experience overseas, because of what they have learned to overcome, because of the challenges they have met, because of the ways they have been tested, if we engage them in the right way, they'll make our communities and our country stronger here at home." Welcome to Focus 580, Eric.
Stephen, it is a pleasure to be on with you. Thank you for having me on.
It's good to hear your voice again. I want to thank you again for your service on behalf of our country.
You are very welcome. It's an honor to serve.
What is The Heart and the Fist about, and why did you write this book?
So The Heart and the Fist is really a book about my service on the front lines. And it's service on the front lines of humanitarian work overseas, where I work with refugees who are survivors of ethnic cleansing in Bosnia, where I work with kids who'd lost limbs to landmines in Cambodia, where, as you mentioned, I worked with Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity in India. It's also about service on the front lines of combat deployments, where as a Navy SEAL I was serving in Iraq and Afghanistan, Southeast Asia, and the Horn of Africa. And then finally, it's about the battle on the front lines here at home, where I'm working in our communities to work with wounded and disabled veterans to help them to rebuild lives of purpose. And The Heart and the Fist is really, in the process of writing it, one of the things that I found was that everyone has a front line in their life. And whether you are a refugee in Bosnia, a Navy SEAL who's trying to make it through this difficult training, or a wounded veteran who's back here at home, your struggle is the same as the struggle that everyone faces, which is that we all have a front line. And the front line is a place where our hopes for our life and our hopes for the people that we love come right up against the reality that the world presents to us. And people struggle on those front lines, but I believe that in order to be effective there, we all need both the heart and the fist. We all need both compassion and courage in order to really triumph there.
In The Heart and the Fist, I really was intrigued by the quote that you put in there by Viktor Frankl toward the end of the book.
Yes.
How human beings create meanings in three ways. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Viktor Frankl, I think, is incredibly insightful. And he wrote his book, of course, Man's Search for Meaning, after his experience in the Holocaust. And he said that human beings really create meaning in three ways. He said, we create meaning through our work. He said, we create meaning through our relationships. And we also create meaning by the way that we choose to meet unavoidable suffering. And one of the key insights that Frankl has and that I talk about in The Heart and the Fist is that we all have pain in our lives, and we all have suffering. And sometimes that pain and that suffering is more evident, as it is in the case of a wounded veteran or as it might be in the case of a refugee in Rwanda. But the fact is that every single one of us has to find a way to turn that pain into wisdom and to turn that suffering into strength. And Frankl talks about the way that we create meaning in our lives by dealing with that unavoidable suffering.
So The Heart and the Fist is a philosophy of life.
It really is. It is a philosophy of life. It's something that I learned just in bits and pieces because I have so many wonderful teachers. And I took little pieces of this philosophy from a lot of people who I worked with. I talk in The Heart and the Fist about, for example, what I learned from my first boxing coach, Earl Blair. Earl had grown up during the Depression, served in the military during World War II, and had spent most of his life raising young men through boxing. He was an incredibly demanding and difficult trainer, and yet he also had this tremendous compassion for us. And one of the things that Earl always taught us was that we should use our strength in order to protect others. And so I took some of Earl's philosophy in. There was some philosophy that I took from some of the toughest people who I've ever met in my life, who are Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity, who work in places like Varanasi, India, with the destitute and the dying. Pieces of that philosophy came from my Navy SEAL trainers, came from some refugee families who I worked with, some great professors who I had in college, and from all of them and through my own process of really trial and error and failure, I've been able to see how the heart and the fist do need to come together in all of our lives.
One of the teachers, again, going back to my introduction,
yes,
was the woman on the train to Croatia.
Yes.
That seemed to be one of the trigger points in your life, and you were very young at the time, maybe 20 or maybe even less than 20. You thought you were just doing great, you know, helping out in these refugee camps, and here you were all the way from America doing this. But she sort of introduced you to the concept of the fist.
That's exactly right. You know, I was riding this train down into Croatia, and I was 20 years old at the time. I was going to work in a refugee camp with unaccompanied children. These are kids who'd been separated from their parents or had lost their parents during the ethnic cleansing. And I felt that I was really going to do a good deed. And I remember she stopped me in the passageway of the train, and she says to me really aggressively, "Are you an American?" And of course I said, "Yes." And then she says to me, "Well, why isn't America doing anything?" And I thought to myself, well, I'm doing something. I'm here. I'm trying to help. I'm trying to be supportive of these kids who had lost their parents. And she said to me, you know, that you're not really helping us. And that was one of the things that she said to me and others said to me. That she said, like, if you really cared about us, you'd be willing to help to protect us. And that introduced me to the idea that sometimes if you really do love something, it's an obvious idea, but if you really love something, you have to do sometimes more than just be caring and compassionate. Sometimes you have to be willing to step forward and protect others.
Mm-hmm. And I think you told me in St. Louis that it's sort of like the protection that a parent has for a child.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And one of the things that I've learned doing this work is that whenever any of us really love something, of course we're willing to care for and be compassionate towards a child, for example. But in the same way, if that child were threatened, then we're willing to step forward and we're willing to protect that child and we're willing to be courageous. And so what we find is, in a really simple way, in our own lives, we don't make a distinction between compassion and courage when we love something. And yet, for some reason, when we think more broadly, we often make these distinctions between military responses and humanitarian aid, or conceptually we make a distinction between what it really means to be good and what it means to be strong. But I think that we all need to find a way to be both good and strong in our lives.
Of course, most of us are not Navy SEALs and,
sure,
and never will be. I have great respect for anyone that's gone through that training, even the ones that rang the bell and said, "I've had enough."
Yes.
So how do we support the idea of the fist? I mean, it seems to me you almost have to separate the chatter of politicians and the chatter of generals, in a sense, and listen more to your heart, as you did.
Yes, and I think you're right, Stephen. I think one of the things that we also need to do is to recognize the role that fist plays in our own lives. It's an extraordinarily small percentage of people who are ever going to be Navy SEALs, but there's so much that comes from that Navy SEAL training that I learned in my life and in the lives of others that's applicable, that helps us to make sense of our own lives. So, for example, Earl Blair was never a Navy SEAL, but there he was trying to raise young men, and he knew that required a tremendous amount of love, but he also recognized that it required great discipline. In the work that we do today with wounded and disabled veterans, we say to them that we're not just going to give you charity, we're not going to just hand you gift baskets and blankets, but we're going to actually ask something of you. Because we recognize that when we challenge you, when we challenge you to find a way to continue to serve, it means that you see that we believe in you. And so in all of our lives, I think there's a way that we can ask ourselves, how does the fist play a role in our life? How am I challenging myself? How am I challenging the people around me? And how am I asking myself and people around me to live with the real courage of perseverance?
I'm Stephen Lyons, today's host of Focus. I'm talking with Eric Greitens. He's the author of The Heart and the Fist. I invite your calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Our email is will-talk@illinois.edu. Chris Hedges wrote once in one of his books that of the past 3,400 years, humans have been at peace for only 268 of those years, or 8% of recorded history. What do you think of this, Eric?
You know, I think that one of the things that is important to understand about peace is that peace is more than the absence of war. And that if we're really going to create peace, we have to think of it in that way, that peace is something that has to be created. And that there's a real art and science to being able to build peaceful communities. And we have to do more than wish for the end of war if we're going to create peace. And so one of the things that I explore in the book is a way that different communities who are many of them victims of war, refugees, survivors of the genocide in Rwanda, refugees in Bosnia, people in Iraq and Afghanistan, what it actually takes to create peace in those environments. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that when you really get down to what the core essence of a warrior is, you know, there's a dual aspect to being a warrior. It's not just being no worse enemy to your enemies, but it's also being no better friend to the people who you care for and love. And you have to be a good friend, you have to be a diplomat, you have to be a role model in order to really build and create that kind of peace.
Mm-hmm. Even refugees have to be challenged, don't they? I mean, I think I remember one instance where the men were becoming the teachers and caretakers and really the fist of the children, the refugees in the Bosnia refugee camps.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that was so amazing for me to see, when I went to Bosnia, keep in mind, I was only, when I was in Bosnia, 20 years old at the time, and I remember being in the refugee camp and seeing refugees step off of the bus into the Goshen Sea refugee camp. These are people who had lost every material possession they'd ever owned. Many of them had lost friends and had lost family. And I thought to myself that if I had been in their situation, I'd be very focused on my own pain. I'd be very focused on what I had lost. And yet what I saw was that the people who did the best, the refugees who did the best in the camp, were the people who were able to step outside of their own pain and think about how they were going to be of service to others. So, for example, a lot of the parents and the grandparents in the camp, because they had young children there, they had a motivation and they had a purpose and a drive, and that was to take care of their kids. Some of the people who did the worst in the camp, I thought, and who were really struggling, many of them were the young teenagers who felt like their entire life had been interrupted by this war, and yet no one was asking them to find a way to continue to serve. So one of the things that was interesting that happened in the refugee camp was that when people asked the teenagers to volunteer, for example, in the kindergarten, when they asked the teenagers to start setting up soccer camps for some of the younger kids, then those teenagers were able to rebuild a sense of purpose in their lives. And so it is true, no matter how much we've suffered, we sometimes find power by stepping outside of our own pain and thinking about how we can serve others.
Mm-hmm. I want to get back to trigger points again in your life. And
yes.
Not Earl Blair, we talked about him, but Bruce Carl.
Yes.
Even further back. I guess I'm trying to get the essence of what led you to do humanitarian work.
You know, Bruce Carl was an extraordinarily important mentor of mine. He was the director of a youth leadership program in St. Louis. And one day, Bruce told me that we were going to go downtown to do some service work at a homeless shelter. And I thought, well, okay, that's fine. I'd done some different community service work before. And then Bruce said to me, and we're going to spend the night down there. And that was really a little bit, you know, I had a little bit of trepidation about that. What does that mean to spend a night in a homeless shelter? And I was a kid who grew up in the suburbs of St. Louis, whose conception of the city was really Busch Stadium and the St. Louis Cardinals and maybe the Art Museum. And here Bruce was challenging me and taking me down to spend a night in a homeless shelter. And I'll never forget, one of the things that made Bruce's leadership so powerful is that even though I was 16 years old at the time, he always talked to me and to the other students with tremendous respect. And one of the things that he made very clear to us was that we could make a difference right there, right where we were at. And he didn't say, you know, one day you're going to be a leader and 10, 20 years from now you can make a difference. He was saying, you can make a difference right now. And the reason he took us to that homeless shelter was because Bruce said, it's so important for you to understand how all of your neighbors are living. And I think having some mentors and coaches like Bruce Carl really helped me to see that I could make a difference in my life in the way that I was able to serve others.
That must have stuck with you so well, because you traveled so extensively. And then after Oxford, when you were at this crossroads in your life where, you know, you could go toward a fairly, I wouldn't say stress-free, but much less stress than the Navy SEALs, but a life of privilege, a life of ease of some kind. But instead you chose, at the age of 26, and listeners, keep in mind that 28 is the cutoff date for Navy SEAL training, so you're one of the older trainees, you decide to go into the SEAL. What was going on in your mind?
Yeah, I write about that decision in The Heart and the Fist, and it was a tough decision to make. I was 26 years old, like you said, and I really had three options in front of me. One option was to stay at a place like Oxford University, where they had offered me tremendous freedom and opportunity. Another option was to go to a consulting firm where they offered me in my first year more money than my parents combined had ever made in any year. And then I had this third option with the United States Navy put on the table. And the Navy's offer was, they said, well, if you come and you sign these papers, then we will pay you $1,332.60 per month.
Approximately.
That's right. I mean, I still remember that because I looked up. I thought, well, what's the Navy says? $1,332.60 per month when you go to officer candidate school. And what the other piece of the deal, they said, is in the minute that you sign your name on those papers, you're going to owe us 8 years. They said, in return, we're going to give you one and only one chance at basic underwater demolition SEAL training. If you make it, they said, then you'll be on your way to being an officer and a SEAL. I said, if you don't, you still owe us 8 years. And, of course, I knew at the time that over 80% of the people that went into the training didn't make it. So it was a tough decision, but there was a moment for me where I really, everything crystallized for me. And I came back to Rhodes House, which is one of the mansions in Oxford there where they were having a fancy party. And I walked in, had a great time. It's this wonderful mansion. And then I looked up and I saw that the names of Rhodes Scholars who had died during World War I and World War II were etched into the walls. And I realized that if it hadn't been for their service, there's no way that I would be standing in Rhodes House looking up at them. And I had to ask myself, you know, I was so fortunate. I had all of these scholarships that were able to pay for my education, and I had to ask myself, what was all of that investment for? And I believe that that investment was made so that I could really be of service to others, and that was part of what led me into the SEAL teams.
I'm Stephen Lyons, today's host of Focus. I'm talking with Eric Greidens, and Eric is the author of The Heart and the Fist. You were wounded in Iraq. What happened?
I was. When I was serving there, I was serving as the commander of an al-Qaeda targeting cell, and my unit's mission was to capture senior al-Qaeda leaders in and around the Fallujah area. And in March of 2007, my unit was hit by a suicide truck bomb. Now, I was very fortunate, Stephen, in that my wounds were minor. I was taken to the Fallujah Surgical Hospital. I was treated there, and I was cleared for full duty 72 hours later. But a lot of the folks who were in my unit were hurt far worse than I was. And it was actually my interactions with them and with some of the returning wounded Marines at Bethesda Naval Hospital, which led me to the work that I do today with wounded veterans.
Okay. We have a call, Eric, from
yes.
Champaign County. Champaign County listener, please go ahead. You're talking with Eric Greidens.
Hi. Well, this is rather complicated, but I am struck by the fact that you were in the Rhodes House, which is the endowment of Cecil Rhodes, the horrific conqueror of southern Africa, the legacy of Rhodesia and all that. It's not common. The Rhodes Scholars were supposed to be white males for many years. It's been broken since then, but that was that's the legacy. And the nightmare of history is kind of what I'm trying to get at. And when you were on the train and going through Croatia, you didn't mention the ethnicity of the person, but I'm struck by what I know about some of the untold story of that area, which was that she could have easily been Serbian, because there was one point where the Krajina Serbs were being ethnically cleansed by Croats and some others, actually, and the U.S. had a role in it, actually. The U.S. was collaborating with various odd sorts, KLA folks. I mean, this is, I don't know if you know this history at all, but it's not much commented on. Kosovo is seen as a successful, and the whole region is somewhat a successful humanitarian intervention. But if you look at what was really sort of happening, the U.S. was helping in the ethnic cleansing of Serbs from Krajina, and it raised the animosity in the region. It did a lot of things. So I know, you know, there are a lot of aggrieved parties in the region, and there are a lot of Bosnians in St. Louis, but and there are a lot of refugees from all sorts of circumstances. But the U.S. role, other than as a libertarian interventionist, is not much commented on. The guy that was the actor in some of the worst part of the dispossession of these Krajina Serbs went on to be a big player in the KLA. I can't pronounce his name. It's too difficult. But
did you have a question for
Jared? I just wanted you to comment on this. You know, do you even know if the person was Serbian?
Thank you. That's a good question. Go ahead, Eric.
People look it up. This, you know,
give Eric a chance to answer.
It's
okay.
It's a great question, and I appreciate you really bringing a kind of thoughtful and passionate response to it. The woman who was on the train happened to be Bosnian. But you're absolutely right that in situations like Bosnia that I write about and places like Rwanda where I write about, once you get on the ground, one of the things that you see is that you see all of these different details and relationships and complications that oftentimes we don't see portrayed in the media. And it's not because reporters aren't trying to do a good job. It's just that oftentimes these situations when you get on the ground have so much more nuance to them than it's even possible to portray in a quick story. And being able to be attentive to that nuance is really important if you're going to be on the ground. And that's true not only in a humanitarian situation, but it's also true in a place like Afghanistan and Iraq. And I write about that in The Heart and the Fist, where in order for us to be effective to create peace, you need to understand the dynamics that are happening within individual tribes and with individual families in order to really help to create peace in a community. So I think that, you know, the larger point that the caller is making, that you really have to understand what's happening at a local level is a really important one.
And also, I think to understand that humanitarian groups don't necessarily represent their country's politics.
I think it's very true that you have to understand that everyone who's operating on that battlefield, sometimes they don't always, you know, they're not always representative of the larger politics of the country. That's a good point.
Let's move on to the mission continues.
Yeah.
This came out of a visit to Bethesda Naval Hospital after you got out of your service, after you left Iraq. And what happened there, and how did this lead to the organization, the mission continues?
So when I came back, I felt like one of the things that I needed to do was to go and visit with some of the recently returned wounded Marines at Bethesda. And I went into the hospital, and for those of your listeners who've had the experience of doing this, you'll know that you walk into one of those hospital rooms, and you're often talking with young men and women in their early to mid-20s. And I started to ask each one of them about, you know, their unit and their hometown and their deployment, and then I said to each one of them, tell me what you'd like to do when you recover. And every single one of them said to me, Stephen, they all said, I want to return to my unit. But the fact was that for many of them, they weren't going to be able to return to their unit. One of them had lost both of his legs. Another had lost the use of his right arm and part of his right lung. Another had lost a good part of his hearing. And so one of the things that I knew they needed, and I wasn't thinking through this consciously at the time, but I think I knew at a gut level that there had to be a way to help these men and women to continue to maintain hope in their lives. And I just said to each one of them, I said, well, tell me, if you can't return to your unit right away, what else you'd like to do.
And every single one of them said to me that they wanted to find a way to continue to serve. You know, one of them wanted to be a teacher, another one wanted to be a police officer, another one thought he wanted to go home and maybe be a mentor and a football coach. And so what became very clear to me in that moment was that it wasn't enough for me and this long string of visitors to come in and say thank you to these men and women. They appreciated that. It meant a lot to them when people said thank you. But in addition to thank you, the other thing that they had to hear was we still need you. They had to know that we saw them not as problems, but as assets, and that we wanted them, when they came home, to be able to continue their mission of public service.
Mm-hmm. I'm Stephen Lyons, today's host of Focus, and I'm Focus 580. I'm talking with Eric Greidens, the author of The Heart and the Fist. So you came back and you started this organization with your combat pay, and you were basically, what, living on a floor of an apartment, and really started with the grassroots financial resources.
Yes, and we were not just grassroots, but probably just the roots. there was hardly even any grass there. But yeah, I felt like this was a really important thing to do, and so I did. I dedicated my combat pay to starting the Mission Continues. Two friends who I called put in some money from their disability checks. And when I moved back to St. Louis to really get this off the ground, I was living on an air mattress dedicated to this mission and trying to figure out a way to build an organization that could help men and women who'd been wounded to find a way to continue a mission of public service. And it was tough there. I struggled for a while. It's a tough thing to raise money. It's a tough thing to bring in publicity and to bring in attention and to engage volunteers. All of that just takes a lot of really hard work. I think what was heartening to me was that I had seen in my own life the couple, Jason and Carolyn Bernhardt-Linier, who worked with street children in Bolivia, and I saw how they struggled and yet the difference that they made. I saw what happened in the life of my boxing coach and the lives that he had saved. I saw with Mother Teresa's Missionaries of Charity the way that they had saved lives and allowed people to live with dignity. And I knew that at the end of the day, I thought, what's the worst thing that can possibly happen to me? No, and I just knew that if I dedicated myself to the right mission, I thought that these things would find a way of taking care of themselves.
And you have three main programs out of the Mission Continues. I know the first is the fellowship program, and I had the wonderful opportunity to meet two of your fellows, or meet one and interview one on the phone, and that was Natalie Williams and Tim Smith.
Yes.
But tell me about the fellowship program, and then maybe a thought or two about these two veterans.
Yeah, we're really proud of our fellowship program at the Mission Continues. What we do in our fellowship program is that we work with one individual wounded or disabled veteran, and we help them to find a way to continue to serve in their community. So with someone like Natalie Williams, for example, who was a Navy veteran who was severely injured during her service, had major facial injuries, lost her eyesight in one eye, came home, went through a very rough and difficult period. What we did for Natalie was we asked her how she wanted to continue to serve. She told us she'd always had an interest in working with kids. We were able to set up a fellowship for her where she worked full-time doing service work at Children's Hospital. And today, as you know, Stephen, I'm very proud to tell everyone that today Natalie is employed full-time at Children's Hospital. And what we find is that as these veterans begin to serve again, what happens is that they reconnect to their strengths. They see that they can have a continued mission here, and they reengage that sense of purpose. One of the things we found is that the most serious injury for veterans comes not because they've lost their eyesight or their hearing or they've been burned. The most serious injury comes if someone loses their sense of purpose. And so the Mission Continues helps veterans to rebuild that sense of purpose through continued service to our communities.
And I think Tim, interviewing Tim, that he had lost his sense of purpose.
Yes.
And another thing I want to comment after you comment on Tim is that both of these fellows that I talked to had almost a sense of, I don't want to say apology, but when I said, what did the rest of us need to know about returning veterans? They said, give us a chance.
Yeah.
I thought that was such an odd response for people who have risked their lives to come back and say, please give us a chance. We're still good people.
I think that it's such a good observation that you make, Stephen. You know, Tim Smith was an Army veteran who had served in Iraq, and Tim had a rough deployment over there. He'll tell you that he lost a lot of his close friends, many of them on the same day, and that when he came home, he had post-traumatic stress disorder. He was having trouble in his relationships at home with his wife and his young son, and he really needed to find a way to rebuild purpose in his life. We set up a fellowship for him at the VA where he was able to start serving other veterans. He went back to school at Washington University, got a master's degree in social work, and today Tim Smith is working full-time at the VA, and he's opened his own business. So another great success story, but you're right that Tim, Natalie, and all of our veterans who come home, sometimes people see them as strong and as an asset, but other times people doubt if a wounded or disabled veteran can continue to make contributions to the community. And I think what all of our veterans would ask for is only that people see them and say to them, not just thank you, but also grab that veteran and say, we need you. We see you as strong. We think you're an asset, and we're glad that you're home so that you can help us to build a stronger community here.
I think so many of us hear all the negative statistics about veterans, and I think they're worth noting. And I think you talked about the highest per capita suicide rate in military history is for these returning vets from this particular war or wars. Between 10,000 and 11,000 veterans a night sleep on the streets homeless.
Correct.
Double the employment rate for veterans who are ages 20 to 30. It's staggering. It really is staggering.
Yeah, we have some really serious problems that we're facing. And you mentioned some of the key ones with suicide and unemployment and homelessness and large numbers of veterans who are coming home with post-traumatic stress disorder. And so if you think about what's happening for this generation of veterans in terms of a battle to successfully reintegrate here at home, there are a lot of reasons to think that we're struggling in that battle. There's also, I believe, some real reasons for hope, and that hope is based on the fact that I believe that most of your listeners believe absolutely in the importance and the power of reaching out to these men and women, and I also believe that these veterans themselves are an asset. The key is how can we figure out a way to take all of those good intentions and that good energy and turn those into really transforming lives so that these veterans can come back and successfully reintegrate. And that's what we're trying to do at The Mission Continues.
We have a call from Champaign.
Wonderful.
Listener, go ahead. Talking to Eric Rydens.
Yeah. Yes. I was wondering when you were talking about the veterans hoping to continue their life of public service, it brought to mind some programs that I don't have any personal familiarity with, so I don't know how well they'd match up, but things like AmeriCorps, I was wondering if you'd been able to make any use of any of the existing government programs for young people in public service that already exist, if that had been of any use or if the populations and services are just too different.
That's a fantastic question, sir. So right now, The Mission Continues is built 100% on donations from individuals and corporations. We haven't accessed any government funding. I have myself gone to talk with the folks at the Corporation for National and Community Service about some of the programs like AmeriCorps. It turns out that there is a real desire on their part to try and engage veterans. But as the programs are legislated right now, they often don't make sense for returning veterans. And I'll give you a couple of specific examples why. So, for example, on the AmeriCorps program, one of the things that they offer at the end of that service is they offer an education grant. Well, for most of our returning veterans who come back who already have the GI Bill, that education grant doesn't really make sense for them in their lives in the same way that it would for a 22-year-old kid who's just graduated from college. Another big attraction for the AmeriCorps folks is obviously the health care. Our veterans are taken care of on the health care side. But perhaps even at a deeper practical level,
our fellowships at the Mission Continues only work because we individually tailor them for every wounded and disabled veteran. And
right.
In the AmeriCorps program, there are these required hours of service, and what we found is that sometimes for our veterans, because of their physical therapy needs, because of the fact that they might be traveling in the hospital and they might have breaks in their service of 1 or 2 weeks, that they can't actually fit into that AmeriCorps model in the way that it's currently set up. But it's an excellent question. It's certainly an area that we're going to continue to explore.
Thank you, listener, for your great question. I'm talking to Eric Greidens, author of The Heart and the Fist. And you have over 120 fellows now, and each fellowship lasts approximately 6 months.
Yes. In fact, Stephen, even just in the time that we've been talking, we now have over 130 fellows. We're actually at 132. So we've got 132 fellows, and I'm proud to tell you that during National Volunteer Week, we're going to bring out over 2,000 people to do service work with and alongside our veterans in over 26 cities, which is going to bring our total number of volunteers who have come out to do community service and rebuild communities alongside veterans. That total number of volunteers will be upwards of 17,000 at the end of National Volunteer Week. So we're really, really proud of the growth that the team's been able to put together here.
Now, it's not easy to let me take a phone call first. We have
a
cell phone caller, and I don't want to run up their minutes, so I want to get right to them. Do you have a question for Eric Greidens?
I do. I first of all would just like to not only thank you for your service to our country, but thank you for your service to our servicemen and women. It moves me to tears to hear you talking. I would like to know what can we, as General Joe Blows, who have, you know, no resources but want to do something desperately to help, what can we do? What can we reach out and do on our part?
Well, ma'am, that's a fantastic question, and there's a couple of really practical things that people can do. Number one of the greatest things that you can do for veterans is to come out and to let them see that you also recognize them as, you thank them for their service and you recognize them as leaders. And so what we do at the Mission Continues is we set up service projects around the country where people come together to do really practical hands-on work in their communities. They do school rehabilitation projects, Soldiers Memorial Beautification projects, and the whole idea is that we ask people to come out and put their hands on some real work in their communities right alongside our veterans. And so if folks are interested in volunteering to do that, they can just look up The Mission Continues. It's available at missioncontinues.org, write into our volunteer coordinators and see how you can get involved. Another really practical thing that we've tried to do is that we wanted to create a way for people to both learn about the issues facing veterans and to tell their friends. So I created something called the Mission Continues Challenge. And people can, again, go out to our website. And to take the challenge, we ask everybody to just take 10 minutes to learn about the issues facing wounded and disabled veterans, make a donation of $10 if they'd like, and then tell 10 friends about what they've learned. Because we think that the more people know about the strengths of our veterans coming home, the bigger difference it will make. So there's definitely a place for everyone who's out there, no matter what your abilities, resources, physical limitations, there's a way for you to become part of the Mission Continues family to help to support this work.
Thank you, listener. I have a question from a colleague of mine at my day job, and her son she doesn't know where he is because he's in special services. He could be anywhere in the world. She wanted to know, why isn't the VA doing a better job with our veterans?
Well, you know, one of the things that's tough about the VA is that after the Department of Defense, I think it may very well be the second largest bureaucracy in the world after the Department of Defense. So you've got hospitals all over the country. You've got tens of thousands of people who are working in the VA. And I can tell you personally, I know that there are some really hardworking, dedicated public servants in the VA who do a fantastic job with some of our veterans. It's also the case that in a massive bureaucracy, too many of our veterans are getting lost, and they just aren't getting the kind of care and attention that they need. And one of the things that we have to do is to help to design that VA system to make sure that all of our veterans get all of the services that they need. Having said that, I also think it's really important for us to recognize that when veterans come home, they certainly need support from the Department of Defense. They need support from the VA, and it's also important for us as their fellow citizens to provide them with some real support as their community.
It's not easy to get these veterans to get help from you. You've talked to me before about we have a lot of young men and women sitting in their house 12 hours a day playing video games, maybe medicating themselves, self-medicating themselves. And it's hard for them to make that initial push to get into your offices. Often it comes from a spouse or an aunt or a husband. Can you talk about that a little bit?
That's exactly right. I mean, today one of the things that's hard is just as we're talking right now on the radio, Stephen, and as all of your listeners are tuned in, the fact is that there are thousands of men and women who are in their house right at this moment and who are going to spend all day inside their house or their apartment today playing video games, self-medicating, really doubting their course and their future here at home in the United States now that they've come home. And for a lot of them, they won't reach out themselves. And it's true that sometimes their aunts and their parents and their brothers and their sisters will call into The Mission Continues and ask if we can do some kind of outreach to their loved one. And one of the things that's so interesting is that a lot of times for these veterans, if you go to them and you say to them, you have to step outside of this house because it's going to be better for you, a lot of times you won't get a reaction. But if we go to them at The Mission Continues and we challenge them and we say, this isn't good enough, we need you to come out of this house because we have an equitherapy center where we want you to volunteer, because we've got a group of at-risk kids who need a youth hockey coach, because we've got a dojo that needs a martial arts instructor, then they will respond because they appreciate the fact that we're asking them, that we see them as an asset, and that we want them to step up and continue their service to others.
It's a charity, not a challenge, I think, is your...
Exactly. That's right. At The Mission Continues, we say it's not a charity, it's a challenge, because we want that idea of the challenge to be really fundamental to our philosophy.
Where are we now with this latest group of returning veterans? We didn't do a great job. We did a horrible job during Vietnam. We did a really good job with World War II. Are we at a tipping point here with this group of returning veterans?
That's such a good observation. I would say that right now the battle is up in the air. You know, when you talk about a whole generation of veterans, you're obviously talking about millions of individuals and lots of different cases. But generally speaking, we welcomed home that World War II generation well, and they came back and they became the civic backbones of our communities. It was also the case that when we welcomed that generation home from Vietnam, a lot of times they weren't sure whether their military service made them stronger or weaker. I'd say that right now, the battle to see what's going to happen for this generation of veterans is really up in the air. And we need people in the community to recognize that it's going to take a heart and fist approach to help all of these veterans to reintegrate, that we absolutely need to be compassionate, we need to be caring. At the same time, we need to find a way to challenge them and bring the kind of courage that we know that they have, bring that courage to their recovery, use the heart and the fist to help them to rebuild their lives here at home.
It's been my experience that so many of us in civilian populations are isolated from military. Military usually live within their own communities. We experience these wars through the media. We often don't even know a veteran or know anyone who has a son or daughter in service, or uncle or father or whatever. What do those of us who are not from military families or know military families immediately, what do we need to know about the returning veterans, and how can we reach out to them?
Such a good point. When you think, and I'll just make a point about knowing veterans first, I think that it's important for people to recognize what a small percentage of the country has borne this tremendous burden now for 10 years. When you think that it's approximately 2.2 million veterans who've served in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's less than 1% of the American population. So it's exactly right that a lot of people just don't know a veteran. They certainly might not know a wounded or disabled veteran who comes home. And yet they do feel that they know that these people served for them, and they want to reach out to them somehow.
And so I think one of the things to know about these veterans and their families is certainly to recognize, first of all, that these are men and women who chose a mission of public service because it was important to them. And one of the things that is important to recognize is that when people come home and they've been wounded or disabled, oftentimes their character hasn't changed. We had one veteran who said to one of my colleagues, he said, "I lost my legs, that's all. I didn't lose my pride in being an American, and I didn't lose my desire to serve." And so perhaps the greatest thing that people should know is that that character remains the same, and that when people come home, we should appreciate and recognize that character and take advantage of it to make all of our communities stronger.
What do veterans think of civilians?
Well, again, it's a very broad, you know, very, very broad population, but it's such a good question because I think that what veterans want more than anything is to make sure that civilians know that this is service that they have done for them and in their honor. You know, I and my fellow veterans, when we're over there, there's a very real consciousness that we're fighting for the people of the United States. We're certainly fighting for each other, and there's a tremendous sense that you take care of your team. And there's a real respect and honor for the people who are at home, and we believe that it's important enough for us to serve and to sacrifice when we're overseas because we really do honor those people who are civilians. And let me also say, civilians should know that their support for the troops is greatly appreciated. I mean, when I was over in Iraq, for example, you know, lots of folks will send care packages and things like that. And I can tell you that I received some deodorant at some pretty critical moments. And also got some great letters from home that school kids had written and things like that. And all of those things are heartening to the troops overseas.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Eric Greidens. He's the author of The Heart and the Fist, The Education of a Humanitarian, The Making of a Navy SEAL. These celebrations that we have for veterans, how important are they when they come home? We have a lot of small towns in Illinois that have where a lot of people have paid the ultimate sacrifice, and we have great celebrations for returning veterans. Is this important to a veteran?
It's extraordinarily important, and it's really important for our communities, and it's important in a larger sense for our whole nation. Ceremony plays a really important role in human life, and military life, you know, recognizes this. There are important ceremonies when people get promoted. There are really important ceremonies when people retire. There are important ceremonies when we recognize people's achievements on the battlefield. And one of the most important ceremonies that you can participate with in your community is that ceremony where a veteran comes home from their service and they're reintegrated into the community. It should absolutely be a moment of celebration. It should be a celebration of all of the freedom that we have as Americans, but it should also be a celebration of the fact that we have these men and women who are willing to go overseas in order to serve us. The one thing that I think we can do is to recognize that after that moment of great celebration, we still have a task ahead of us of making sure that those veterans are reintegrated well into our community, and that we should use that moment of celebration as a way for us to all make a commitment to say, these men are coming, men and women are coming home. Let us honor their service. Let us show them how much we appreciate them. And then let us be inspired to help them to reintegrate into their communities and, again, to make us all stronger.
Well, thank you, Eric. That's a great place to end. Again, we've talked to Eric Greidens, the author of The Heart and the Fist from Houghton Mifflin, and also the founder and CEO of The Mission Continues. Eric, it's been a pleasure. I wish you all luck with the book. And, again, thank you for your service.
Stephen, thank you. Pleasure to be on with you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields, on Springfield Avenue in Urbana. Today's programs are made possible by 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign, celebrating 26 years of fair trade on October 8th. 10,000 Villages creates opportunities for artisans in developing countries to earn income by bringing their products and stories to our markets through long-term fair trading relationships.
And at a minute before 12 o'clock, I'm Jeff Bossert, your host for the Afternoon Magazine. Sitting in for Celeste Quinn today, we'll first have a look at the markets. In Kansas City, hard red winter wheat for December at 771, that's up 6. In Chicago, December wheat at 673 and a quarter, that's down 1.5. March for a 708 and three quarters, down 2.75. December corn, 691 and a half, up 1.25. March corn, 704, that's up 1. May, 711 and a quarter, up 3/4. November crude oil, 87.10, that's up 17. For November soybeans, 13.29 and 3/4, down 8.25. January, 13.41, down 7.75. March, 13.48 and 1/4, that's down 8. October soybean meal,